Hello, you're listening to Just Screen It, Case Studies in Creative Distribution. I'm your host, Colin Stryker, and I am not an expert in indie film distribution. I am an independent filmmaker working towards making my first narrative feature, a horror film entitled The Grove. As I've been contemplating my own eventual distribution strategy, I've come to the conclusion that we need more data, more transparency, more information about how the various distribution options that are out there have worked for people. So I decided to start this podcast to help capture some of the experiences of those who have already been through it, whether successful or otherwise, and from those experiences, help both listeners and myself better understand this really complex, crazy landscape of independent film distribution today. So each week, I'll be bringing on a filmmaker who has self-distributed or been personally involved in the distribution of their film. My hope is that future filmmakers can take the knowledge gleaned from the show and use it to make their own decisions on how to best distribute their films. Hey folks, I've got a great one for you today. Steve Rudzinski has carved out an impressive career for himself, making and distributing a wide variety of indie films. Along the way, Steve leaned heavily on horror conventions to sell his movies and build a strong and loyal fan base. Through his scrappy efforts, Steve managed to get to a place where he rejects traditional distribution offers in favor of releasing his films himself, and even more impressively, actually manages to make a living from it. This is a great lesson in career building for the truly independent filmmaker. A whole lot for listeners to glean here from Steve's experience, so I will get right to it, my inspiring conversation with Steve Rudzinski. All right, I'm here with Steve. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Good to have you on. I did watch Carousel last night, so fun little movie.
I hope it made you laugh.
Yeah, sure did. You want to tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Sure. Carousel, the first Carousel, because it is a trilogy, is about a sentient carousel unicorn that comes off of the ride in order to hunt down an especially bratty kid for revenge, because the kid was just abusing him on the ride. So it's a revenge story where Duke the Unicorn is the protagonist, and he kills anyone in his way to get to this kid.
Yeah.
The sequel is about Duke finding out about his origins, as well as finding out that he is a father to a half-human, half-unicorn son. So he wants to be a better person for the sake of his son, while killing Nazis. And the third film is it's a movie about revenge, redemption, the bad things one does not going away just because you're a better person.
Yeah.
At the same time that a carousel rabbit is hunting Duke down for his power.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah, a lot to go with there. And I'll just say, I hope this is a fair characterization, but I'll say that it's all very kind of low budget, schlocky comedy horror kind of stuff that just kind of, you know, the unicorn isn't even really animated. It's just, but it kind of works. It works in this, like, you know, sort of, I don't know, you know, low budgety, fun, sort of low stakes kind of way. I hope that's a fair characterization, you know.
I make live action cartoons. That's the way I describe it. You know, my biggest inspirations as a director, you know, it's Sam Raimi and John Arcuri, who directed all the Ernest P. Worrell stuff. So that should give you an idea of my tone. But I also weirdly care about things like story progression and character arcs at the same time. Like, there's really dumb, serious, dramatic moments in Carousel 3, and yet it's this series about an inanimate, sentient carousel unicorn the whole time. Like, it never stops being that.
Yeah, totally. I think that's great. So yeah, how'd you get started with all this filmmaking stuff? Like, take us back to your origins, how you got into it, and then we'll kind of, you know, go from there, talk about your distribution experiences.
Well, I mean, origins, I saw Army of Darkness when I was 12 and knew I had to make movies.
Nice.
You know, in high school, did awful backyard films, did stuff for the internet. I was one of the first people on YouTube at the time. I was a YouTube director when that mattered. I got to upload videos longer than 10 minutes, kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And just kind of, I tried to make a couple of movies, but it was like when I was 19, like very, very young, and I wasn't sure what I was doing. I didn't have budgets. I didn't have access to stuff. Over time, I did focus more on doing some internet series, some shorts for the internet. And in about 2010 is when I kind of said, I need to take this more seriously. You know, this is what I want to do. So I made a short, I shot it at the end of 2010. And we released it in 2011 called The Slasher Hunter, just a parody of 80s slasher movies. Enough people liked it and it made me some money that then I made a feature film called Everyone Must Die in 2012, which is awful, but it is, you know, officially my first feature film of my career. But someone liked it, enough that he wanted me to make his movie idea. That was Captain Z. At the same time, I wanted to make my own tokusatsu, so I just took a couple $1,000s to shoot that right before Captain Z. So Super Task Force 1 was in 2013, then Captain Z was in 2014. That was the time we actually wrote Carousel 1. We wrote it in 2014,
Okay. But
the Kickstarter for it failed. We only raised about $1,000. It was an Indiegogo, so we did the partial funding, and we took the $1,200 that we did get, and we bought the horse. You know, that was just the cost of Duke. And I was like, well, I don't know, we'll try to do a short or something later. So at the end of 2014, I did another movie that I don't like at all called Red Christmas. It was the first one, not the one with Dee Wallace. They took my title. It was a found footage torture horror movie, and I don't like those genres, but I wanted to see what my version of those would be. I don't like my versions of that, but some of my fans do. You know,
yeah,
several people have come up to me and be like, this is my favorite movie of yours. I'm just, why? I don't know. Then we ran into someone that really wanted to finance Carousel 1. So we shot that and released that in 2016. I did another short film in 2016 to wrap up the story I had done up to that point, just for like the three fans that cared about that. Carousel did pretty decently. You know, people cared about it. People liked it. It was still in the red, though, and I didn't feel comfortable doing another five-figure budget film yet. So in between Carousel 1 and 2, I did a few Talking Cat children's movies. Meowy Christmas, which I made out of spite and rage, because every single one that I had watched was just a Home Alone ripoff, except with six figures of budget and not a creative script at all.
Yeah.
I made a weird one. Did great. It did great. So I've always wanted to make a PG horror film. So 2018 was a Meowy Halloween. One of the best financial decisions of my life.
Wow.
Was that film. And the fans loved it, and the fans kept demanding more, but I didn't want to fall into the pit of only making talking animal movies for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I did Meowy 3 and 4, St. Patrick's Day and Christmas Vacation, to kind of give it an ending. You know, the insane concept of giving the talking animal children series a conclusion. That's what I do. So we wrapped that up. And then in 2021, you know, the fans kept on asking for Carousel 2. The fans wanted Carousel 2, but Carousel 1 was still in the red. And at that point, a distributor still had it, so I wasn't really making any money off of it. I got the rights back since. So we did a Kickstarter, and I said, look, you know, put your money where your mouth is. If you guys want the sequel, I'll make it, but you got to fund it. They funded it.
Nice.
So 2021 was Carousel 2. At that point, I was reached out to be hired to produce and direct someone else's movie again. That was Shingles the Movie. We shot it in 2022. It didn't get released until 2023 because the editing took a while. While the editing was happening, I saw what the Amityville series has become and thought it was insane and crazy and stupid, and I hated what happened to it. But then I noticed there wasn't a Christmas one yet. So I was like, well, if someone's going to make a Christmas Amityville movie,
sure,
it should be me.
Yeah.
So it's a Hallmark rom-com parody, except the love interest that thinks about quitting her job because of the Christmas guy is a ghost.
Nice.
And we shot that in 2 days. I spent $300 because I was like, I need to get this done before someone beats me to the punch. Although, because that's how fast these things are coming out.
Right.
And of course, that one has gotten me more press, more coverage, more sales than any movie I've ever made. Something I shot in 2 days as a joke.
Yeah.
It has Amityville in the title.
You just never know. Right. Yeah.
And then we got to release Shingles in early 2023. And at that point, it was like, okay, I'm feeling good. I'm in the zone. I'm in the mood. Let's wrap up the Carousel trilogy that we've had planned since 2014. Launch another Kickstarter. Fans supported it. It raised the money even quicker. We shot it and released it in 2023. Super happy about that. And now we're in pre-production on our new feature, which I want to release this year in 2024, which is Curtains for Christmas.
Nice.
So keep an eye out for that. I'm very excited about Curtains for Christmas.
All right. Sounds cool. So yeah, great, great history there. Really appreciate you kind of recounting all that. And then, you know, so we'll drill down a little bit and talk about kind of different experiences, different distribution experiences. Okay, so take us back to those early years at first. And then, you know, I'm sure you've seen a lot of changes in like how distribution has evolved and things like that over your time. So take us back to your first feature. Your first feature, can you remind me what the title was?
Of my real career, my first feature is Everyone Must Die.
Okay.
You know, I'm not including the stuff I did in the backyard when I was in high school. And
sure,
stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Feature length.
Right. Okay. Yeah, kind of the first one that maybe you had ambition of actually getting out there into the world and having strangers watch it, you know?
Yes.
So this would put us back in, you know, kind of 2014 to 2012 territory. Okay. So when you were undertaking that, first of all, like what were you thinking about in terms of budget? Were you thinking just something I can make all on my own, self-fund myself, or were
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
my co-writer put in like $750 and I put in the rest. Our total budget was about $3,000 to $3,500. It was very, very low. We had like a 7-day shoot schedule. I paid all the actors, but like we shot it ourselves. You know, my friend Scott Lewis helped us out, kind of kindness of his heart. I gave him $200 out of my own pocket just because I appreciated the help, but that was never part of the budget. It was the worst shoot that I've ever been in charge of. Not the worst shoot I've been on, I'll say that.
Right, yeah.
So I have a slight silver lining to that, but it was rough. It was long. It was hot. We didn't have, you know, good locations, but we powered through it. You know, like we made it through all 7 days. It is a point of pride that I've never gone past my shooting schedule. I've never gone over schedule. I've never gone over budget. I've never done any of that. So at least we finished on time and we were able to cut the movie together and get it out and released. So people did get to see it. You know, I was taking it to conventions. It did get picked up by MVD at the time.
Okay.
It did okay. You know, I got checks. I think that is one of my only movies that is still technically in the red over the years.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't a total wash. And again, that opened up the opportunities for, it started to get me a fan base, and doing Super Task Force immediately afterwards helped establish that, like, I'm going to get weird with it instead of only doing horror movies. And the Captain Z gig, which was right after that, which I got paid to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, was given a budget to work with, helped me kind of grow also as a filmmaker at the same time, instead of only being locked into that sort of like, I guess I'm just making $3,000 movies every time.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's super cool. So when you went into making that first feature, did you have any kind of distribution plan in mind, or was it just sort of make it and get it out there, like see what happens kind of thing?
I mean, at that point, I had been making dumb backyard movies as a teen,
yeah,
and I still sold those. So I was just going to follow that same marketing aspect of it, which was get vendor booths at horror conventions, try to get screenings at the same horror convention so the drunks watch the movie and then come over to my booth. And that's the best way that I felt that I could reach strangers.
Yeah.
You know, I shot it out to a bunch of review websites back when those were more of a thing back in the day. And, you know, I put together, you know, I hired someone to do like the box art, you know, I did the menu art. I try to make it look as professional as possible. Some independent game maker licensed the rights to do a card game for it, which was mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah.
These days we've designed our own games for Carousel because then we actually get to sell them ourselves. But, you know, I try to do products. I try to do with a CD of like the score and the original theme songs that I had written for the movie.
Yeah.
And I shipped copies to multiple distributors because that was one of the few movies that I was like, I do want to try to get distribution for this film.
Yeah.
Especially at that point, I was so inexperienced and so unknown
right.
that I knew I needed kind of like that extra push to try to reach people that wouldn't know I existed. And that was before Film Hub. That was before, you know, Patreon wasn't really that known at that point. So there weren't as many options. And I got picked up by MVD, which was great. They gave me new box art, which looks great. They got it into Hastings when that still existed. You know, I did get into some stores.
Yeah.
And that helped, you know.
Did you try to play the film festival circuit at all, or was that not for you?
I have never been a film fest guy.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
I'll send out to a few film fests if I know them and like trust them, you know, if it's one that I know that they do air a bunch of like indie stuff and has a good crowd. But I've never been a guy that chased the film fest because I don't care about the wheat. You know, I don't care about the accolades. I've always known that unless you get into like one of the top five, it's not like distributors are going to film fests. You're not getting more marketing from most of the film fests. It's just, it's a lot of money. And if that's what you want to do, it can be fun to travel around and stuff, but I can't afford to travel around all the film fests and meet other people. I would rather send it to a horror convention who plays the movie. They don't charge me if they choose the movie. And then at the time also pay for a booth, or now these days, you know, I'm invited as a guest.
Yep.
And that was my plan, like horror cons, screenings at the cons where I know paying customers are. That was the focus.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I don't think I've heard too much. Maybe there are a bunch of horror filmmakers out there that do that. I haven't heard too much about it. So it's great to hear your take on it. And I'm sort of, you know, I'm wondering, like, thinking again back to that first feature, we'll definitely, you know, talk about your more recent experience, but like, you know, with a sort of a $3,000 budget, like how much did it cost to actually rent one of these booths? Did you have to, and it sounds like you put some stuff into deliverables and, you know, DVDs and things like that. Like, did you have to kind of put in a bunch more money after you made the film to sort of make it so that you could sell copies of it or sell it in some manner?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the convention, and it's a bit, this is like a decade later, but depending on the convention, it, you know, it was anywhere from $150 for a booth to $300 for a booth.
Not too bad. Yeah,
I know that the bigger conventions like Horror Hound and stuff is more like four figures.
Okay.
I wasn't hitting those at the time. So it's a case where, like, but then you're also looking at hotel, food costs while you're there, because, you know, there's rarely cheap options in that sort of like environment. So I was getting the booths, you know, getting the hotels, doing the travel. And at that point, the goal was I need to sell enough to break even on the booth.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, like, over time, it was like, I need to sell enough to break even on the booth and the hotel. That'd be nice. And, you know, these days it's like, yeah, profit, baby. You know, like, I got a library. It's easy to, like, push all these out now these days.
Right. Right.
But at the time, it was like, I'm probably taking a loss on these trips. But this is reaching the people, and it was fun. You know, it's still enjoyable to get out there. You know, I'm a horror fan, so getting to, you know, rub shoulders with, like, a bunch of people that I grew up watching and, like, other fans, you know, it was still worth it, but it wasn't always financially a win.
Right, right. Yeah, totally. But did you kind of have an awareness at that point that you were sort of investing in building a fan base that would probably take, you know, more than one film to actually pay off? Like, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. And that's interesting.
That's,
okay.
That's one of those things that, like, I have given as advice, like panels and stuff I've been a guest at, which is like one of the first things I said way back in 2011 was like, I want to make at least one film a year for the next 10 years, because I have known back then, today, probably in the future, I've known a lot of guys that, like, put all of their eggs into, like, one movie basket, and they got one movie. And it could be a great movie. Like, this isn't a knock on that concept. Like, it could be a great movie. But, like, if it's a genre movie, like, if it's a horror film, you could sell that thing like hotcakes. But once that sells, you're done. Like, it's hard to get new sales when you don't have anything new to sell. In addition to that, if you only got the one film, it's a little harder to grow your fan base. That's one reason why I wanted to do the tokusatsu. Another reason why I have the PG Cat movies is just that way I'm not only focusing on, like, this one niche. And I love that niche. I'm part of that niche. But by having different genres, you know, like the romantic comedy, you know, the silly talking cats, the over-the-top insane carousels, and, like, the more straightforward gore films like Everyone Must Die, it's easier by comparison to have grown that. And that is what has happened to this point. You know, I was able to surpass that goal that I set for myself. And I honestly do see, like, the fruits of that labor with, like, how so many people, if they don't know me and they come to my booth, they're like, oh, so, like, what are these? Like, oh, these are my films. Like, you made all of these? Like, you know, wolf eyes. Like, and then it's just like, yeah, I got all these freaking things on my tables. Tell me what you're interested in, and we'll work from there. I never wanted to just be I got one movie for the next 3 years or 4 years or whatever. You know, I knew I had to keep at it. And again, a few of those things, I got lucky with being hired by someone else, and that counted, you know, towards my goal. But, you know, I never stopped pushing to try to reach that goal, because it is a slow climb.
Yep.
And I always say that, like, I've been doing this since 2011. In 2021 is when I finally felt like, okay, we did it. Like, I made it.
Wow.
People care.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it took 10 years. And that's, like, you know, I think that's a good thing for filmmakers to hear, that it's not about necessarily, like, the one film that gets you everything and all of a sudden you've made it, you're in Hollywood. And you know, especially these days, I think, where that sort of story of, like, you know, doing your Clerks and getting into a film festival, getting picked up by Miramax and, you know, all of that, you know, those days are over. And so these days, I think it's more about filmmakers, like, building a career for themselves of their own films, their own voice over several films. And in order to do that, you have to kind of keep at it and keep churning them out. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did.
Yes.
And it took a while, you know, but 10 years later, you got a fan base and a sort of a, you know, a self-sustaining cycle mm-hmm. where you kind of know when you make a movie, you don't have to make it with as much uncertainty, I think, as some of the like first-time filmmakers, where they have no idea how successful they're going to be. You have a certain level of success that's kind of built into your plan now, into your operation, and that you can kind of count on as you make each movie. I'm not saying that every movie is going to like, you know, be a huge success or anything like that, but you have a certain fan base, it sounds like, that you can kind of count on to at least kind of keep it going, you know. Would you say that that's fair?
At this point, I can be confident that whenever I make a new film, we're making a profit.
Yeah, and that's a really great place to be.
It may not be a big profit or anything like that, but we're not going in the red anymore on every single project. Every project's still like a risk in the sense of like the time investment and will it be worth it, but it's not like we're just burning money.
Which
is great.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I want to kind of take you back in time a little bit again and kind of get back to those early days. Like, you got that first film done, and I think you said like you got picked up by some kind of distributor. I forget who you said it was, MVD or something like that.
MVD,
And not somebody that I've heard of. So that maybe shows my ignorance. But
these days they've shifted more to just like being the manufacturers for distributors instead of being a distributor themselves.
Gotcha. Okay. What was that process like then, getting picked up by them? Was it a struggle? Did you just send it to a bunch of places? Did they approach you? Like, how did that
happen? No, I sent it to a bunch of places, probably like 10 different places. I don't remember at this point.
Yeah.
And a few places got back to me. And simply put, MVD had the best offer and were also the most legitimate company of the ones that got back to me. You know, a couple of the companies I know were, you know, they had their fan bases, but I also knew that I would never see a cent. And they would keep the movie forever, and I didn't want that to happen. You know, I wanted a timeline where I would eventually get the film back, and when MVD gave me the rights back, it was like no frills, no fight. They were just like, yep, no problem. You know, we made some money off your movie. You know, if you're happy, cool. Here's the 60 last DVDs we have. Just take them, which was great, compared to other distributors I've worked with that just threw all of their inventory in the trash rather than me getting to touch it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was straightforward. You know, I've worked for some smaller studios, and I was already friends with other multiple independent filmmakers at the time. So I was able to like show them the contract, get feedback, you know, be told like what I should be looking for. You know, the split was pretty fair. I think it was at 70% for me and MVD's like charges, because every distributor, you know, for your listeners, if this is your first episode, every distributor charges for crap that they claim they need to do, even if they're doing it in-house, so that you always start in the red with them.
Yep.
I made enough to get out of the red with MVD.
Wow. Okay.
Because their prices were fair. Their prices made sense. And also something that I really appreciated with them, and they weren't the only company to do this, but not every company does this. When I gave them a bunch of bonus features, they jam-packed all of that onto the DVD through Blackmagic, which was cool. And I think they also really appreciated that because of how many indie releases are so bare bones.
Yeah.
That was just like, here's a couple hours of extra stuff. They're like, oh yeah, let's put all that on. So that was a nice experience.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. And probably a kind of an unusual experience for some filmmakers anyway, you know, who've had, you know, worse deals. They don't get as much, you know, communication with their distributor, that kind of thing. So sounds like you had a really great experience with them. That's really cool. So what was kind of like, so after that, what was kind of your next step? Like, what happened after that kind of specifically to sort of set you on the path that you ended up on now, where you have this, you know, as we talked about, like kind of more dependable fan base and stuff. Like, what was the, you know, how did things turn out for you right after getting that first film with that distributor?
Oh, right after, like I briefly touched upon, I was reached out to hire to write and direct a film for a client. But before that, because I knew that was going to be like 8 to 10 months away or something at the time, I really wanted to make my own tokusatsu. And, you know, for those of you listening, a tokusatsu, it's a genre that is most known as, say, Power Rangers. But, you know, there's also Kamen Rider, there's Gyver. Godzilla is considered a tokusatsu.
Okay.
And I it's always been one of my favorite genres. And I was just like, I should make one right now. I should write something that I could afford to do.
Yeah.
Because, like I said earlier, I want people to immediately know that I'm not just making horror comedies, that I could do any genre. And also the fact that it would be more PG meant that I could also target a younger audience.
Interesting. Okay.
So I wrote that. I shot that, you know, over the course of a few weekends, just, you know, myself. That had a budget of maybe $2,000. My fans raised $1,000 of that for me. just through pre-orders.
That's cool.
I was able to shoot that, get the suits made, get a CGI giant robot fight, which is vital to the genre. Got a sick theme song and got to release that. And like the theatrical premiere of that movie was like the day before we started shooting for Captain Z.
Wow. Okay.
Which was a nice high to then roll into the next film, which, you know, that was a five-figure budget of $15,000. And that was nice, you know, to go from 3,000 to 2,000 to now 15. So we had so many more locations. I was able to hire a bigger cast. We were able to get a more dedicated effects team.
Were you able to draw any salary for yourself at all? Or were
Yes, I got paid for that. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Right. Yeah, that's right. You said that already. Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. Cool. But, you know, getting to make that, and that was more like a kind of a PG-13 Army of Darkness in terms of tone and delivery. So that, again, inadvertently, because I didn't have that movie planned or anything, that, again, pushed me as like, okay, well, this guy isn't just making slasher movies.
Right.
You know, he's made a parody of 80s movies. He's made a slasher movie. He made a Power Rangers homage. And now he's making this time-traveling pirate fighting demons, which has kind of been the horror genre, but this isn't a horror movie. So it all of that kind of back-to-back-to-back-to-back really helped me in my early days. So that by the time we did get to make and release Care as Hell, which was a couple years after this, to be fair, it wasn't unexpected. Like, the fans that I already had, once they were, like, seeing the trailer for the Carousel, they were like, oh, hell yeah, we know what we're getting here.
Yeah.
And then the people that weren't familiar with me, they could kind of look at my IMDb and be like, oh, this guy's weird. Let's see what this is.
Yeah, yeah. So take us to Carousel then. And like, what was your... This is something that you'd kind of started writing, and it took a little bit before you were able to go into production with it. Did I understand that correctly? Okay.
Yeah.
And what were you like? Were you looking into trying to raise kind of a bigger budget compared to your past films? Like, what was your thinking and strategy about sort of financing and then ultimately distributing that one?
Well, for Carousel, you know, we had just gotten done with Captain Z.
Yeah.
Captain Z had that $15,000 budget. So Aline, who came up with the idea, and I kind of were like, well, let's kind of stay within that budget range again. You know, that feels that's something we're comfortable with. That's something we can work with. And we'll do this in a way that, like, I won't get paid on Carousel. Aline didn't get paid on Care as Hell, so we can put kind of that money extra into the effects or the locations or the actors.
Gotcha.
And so again, we wrote it in 2014. We tried an Indiegogo. It failed. We got the $1,000 to get the horse. And then we met...
Sorry to interrupt, but let's talk about the Indiegogo a little bit. Can you talk about like why that failed? Like what happened with that? Just
dude,
curious.
I don't know, man. Like,
okay, sure.
To this day, I will see some other guy with nothing but AI art raise $35,000 in a week.
Yeah.
I will see another guy who has made one movie before raise $50,000 somehow. And we just got done struggling to raise $14,000 for curtains for Christmas. And I'm an established guy that has been doing this for over a decade. I don't know. Like, I've reached out, like, so what do you do different? Like, what do you do? And, like, everything they list is just stuff I do. So I don't know how much of it is they know people that have more money than I do, or if it is the case where, like, yeah, they raise $50,000, but they're putting $25,000 of it into these two, like, cameo actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means, like, the budget, their actual budget of the movie is about the same as what I have, but they're able to get these two actors to raise that money easier. I don't know. I prefer casting people that are somewhat known in the indie scene, in the horror or otherwise, you know, first timers and stuff, because I like to put my money into the effects, into locations and stuff. You know, the selling point of my films, at the risk of sounding narcissistic, is my style at this point.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And people have pointed that out, but just like Steve, I think it is really cool that, like, you know, it was a struggle, but like, you've had all these successful Kickstarters at this point, and it's just you. Like, it's just you selling what you do. Like, there isn't that A-list actor or B-list actor pushing it. It's just, oh, it's a Steve Brzezinski movie. Hell yeah.
Right, right. So, I'm sorry, you just said successful Kickstarters. Is that what you meant to say? So, did you eventually see success with crowdfunding?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. So, you had that first failure, and you still don't really understand why that happened. But then later on, you were able to actually do some successful crowdfunding campaigns. So, that's interesting. So yeah, we'll maybe talk about that a little bit more, but I did divert you with that question. You were kind of talking about building up to Carousel. So, you know, if you can kind of remember where you were, I don't know if you can, but, you know, kind of back to that. Yeah.
We got the horse, and the plan was just like, okay, I'll do the Survivors, which was like my dumb Avengers parody, because it was like a character from Slasher Hunter, Everyone Must Die, and Captain Z all in this movie. And then after that, we'll make a Carousel short and kind of see how people react to it and try again.
Interesting.
But, you know, someone in our life who's the producer of Carousel, Rob Steinbach, he was an extra in Captain Z that I just said, hey, you might have fun. Do you want to come and die in the movie? He was like, yeah. And he had a great experience. It was the worst day of shooting for me, but he had a great experience.
Yeah.
And he rewatched the movie when he was flying back to the area that we live in. And he was just thinking about oh man, this is such a good movie. I love this movie. Steve is good at this. And at a get together of friends, we were just, someone asked what's going on with Carousel? I was like, oh, well, we tried, the Indiegogo, it failed. So, we're just trying to put it together. We'll see what happens next year. And he said, well, how much do you need? Well, the budget is $15,000. He's like, oh, I'll take care of that for you.
Oh, wow.
Just because he loved the idea and he really wanted to see the movie exist. And he was a hands-off financer. He said, I don't want to approve anything. I don't want to know anything. You just make the movie and then give me my cut after you release it. It was that unicorn.
Unicorn, right. Yeah.
I'll never meet another financer like that again.
Yeah,
but
wow.
I did it once and when it mattered. So he was able to finance it, and that's when we started the casting process. We put everything together, and we shot that in May or June of 2016.
Okay.
And I knew I wanted to get it cut fast and out so that I can premiere it at this horror convention in Cleveland called Cinema Wasteland, which is the biggest hotel convention, I think is a good way to put it. It's not one of the big, big ones like a Horror Hound or even a Texas Frightmare or something, but of the horror conventions that's still in a hotel, it's probably the most popular, if not at least one of the most popular. So I knew the crowd would eat it up, but I needed it done by then. And I got it done by then, and that screening, Ken likes my stuff for some reason. He'll screen any of my movies if I send it his way, even if it's not in the genre of Cinema Wasteland at all. He will screen. That thing was sit on the floor room only. And
nice.
It was one of the loudest crowds in a good way that just ate it up. And it was the biggest hit of that show that weekend.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. And did you sell some DVDs off of that as well?
Oh yeah.
Blu-rays. Yeah. Right.
DVDs and Blu-rays. And we did real well.
Yeah.
Real well.
That's great. So how much is, cause you talk about the conventions a lot, obviously that's a big thing mm-hmm. in your world and you make some money off of it, I'm sure. But how much attention are you paying to streaming platforms at this point? Is that a big part of your strategy as well? Or are you really focused on the conventions kind of to the exclusion of all else?
Well, I'm not focused on conventions anymore because streaming has killed people that buy physical media.
Okay. That's really interesting. Okay. So just kind of take us back to then, and then we'll get up to,
sure.
how are things are now. So back then, what are you thinking about streaming?
I mean, back then, I had a couple things on Prime Video directly.
Yeah.
That was back when Prime Video still allowed indies to submit and still put indies on the platform.
And that's where you could make a little bit of money from it. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Back then, I remember vividly, they would pay us 14 cents per hour streamed, which was insanely good. And then that dropped to 10 cents. Then that dropped to 5 cents. Then that dropped to 1 cent today. These days Tubi pays the most and I still think it's only about 5 cents per stream. So at that point, yeah, I was making gangbusters off of Super Task Force. That was one of the motivations of me making the cat movies because the kids movies do so good on streaming. They did back then, they still do now because kids will rewatch. Kids will rewatch. And also when something's more PG, it comes up in the suggestions of way different movies. Vacation is an Amityville movie, but it's a PG rom-com parody that also does really well. This month, this is March. It's March 20th. Amityville has already, it's made $50 on Tubi compared to Carousel making $7. I made most of my money from September to December.
Okay.
All year long on streaming. But back then, streaming wasn't one of my core focuses because even though streaming still paid the most, I didn't have that big of a library yet. And physical was still where I made most of my money. It still is today. But back then, it was a different beast.
Do you have a website that people can order from, that kind of thing, too? I did briefly look at your website when you sent it to me, but I didn't look at it that much detail.
Yeah, I have my own online store for all my physical stuff, the DVDs, the Blu-rays, but also the deck building games, posters, soundtracks when I have them. That is silverspotlightfilms.com.
Yep.
And I also, today, these days, I have my own subscription service. I call it Steve Busters.
Nice.
SteveBuster.com. And it is where, for $3... my fans can just get all of my modern movies, you know, from 2011 to now, plus a couple of exclusives that I shot. Or for $5, you also get every bonus feature that I've made for all of my physical releases.
Nice.
And a lot of like other exclusive stuff that's only on things like anniversary rewatches or like retrospectives, you know, or even like some shorts that I made just for the $5 tier. So that's another option because, you know, these days, especially, you still run into people that are like, oh, I don't have a player.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, here's an option that's more than 5 cents to me.
Right.
You know, if you subscribe to my Patreon for 1 month and watch all of my movies and save them, I don't care, save them, I'll still make significantly more money than if you were to just stream them all on a service.
Yeah. Okay. That totally makes sense. And I think that's great. I think it's great for like filmmakers to find a way. I don't know if it's always going to be successful or not, but find a way to kind of bypass those streaming platforms that mm-hmm. you make nothing on, mm-hmm. even though everybody, you know, filmmakers want to be on Amazon because that's where everybody expects to be able to watch their film or whatever. But at the same time, like, you know, you're making nothing off of Amazon, you know? So if you can find a way to get them out there in ways that feel more exclusive, in ways that talk directly to your fan base mm-hmm. and your fan base can kind of interact with you directly. Of course, that requires building up a fan base, which gets back to what we talked about before. It's not necessarily something you do with your first movie, but if you can kind of get yourself into that position, I think that is such a great way for filmmakers to kind of maintain an existence as filmmakers, is just Absolutely. Have this like direct, you know, relationship with their fans where they make a film, they deliver it, they get paid some, they make the next film and kind of back and forth and back and forth and just take all of those gatekeepers out of the equation.
Which is what you need, especially in the indie thing. And this yeah, goes to yeah. like every sort of entertainer, you know, from like artists, sex workers, honestly, like yeah. it's the same yeah. idea yeah. of like Hollywood exists, Disney Plus exists. Why are people coming to me? It's because of the direct relationship I try to have with my fans. It's because they want to support this indie schmuck over, you know, Max and Zaslav. And it is that case where, like, streaming is great for trying out new things. You know, I love to use streaming, but we're running into that thing where, like, streaming has made individual works disposable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, people will not even pay attention to who directed a movie if they loved it on Tubi. You know, if Carousel 2 doesn't pop up on the recommended, they may never watch 2 and 3, even if they call one, like, their new favorite indie film of all time.
Right.
I have fans that have given me money for my movies that were like, wait, you made Talking Cat movies? It's just like, I never shut up about them when I made them. But that's the reality of what we're living in. So it's like trying to find these different avenues to try to reach as many people as possible. And like streaming is great passive income. I love that it's there. You know, I do pretty decently on it compared to a lot of guys I know. I'm lucky, but I still make more money on the Patreon. I still make more money on okay. physical sales, even though, you know, compared to 2014, I sell way less copies than I did. But it's still more money than streaming at the end of the year.
Right, right. Yeah, because there's that extra value associated with it that people are willing to pay. I mean, you probably sell a DVD for, what, $20, you know, something like that?
I try to do about 15 unless it's one of my cheaper okay. movies, then I'll sell it for like 10 or 11.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So that's a little bit less than maybe I would expect to pay for a good DVD. But yeah, I mean, that's totally cool. So take us back to, you know, to Carousel. And is that, would you kind of call that your most successful movie? Like, I don't know exactly where you put that in kind of the
grand scheme. It is hard to say, honestly. I think Carousel is probably what I'm most known for sure. as an individual yeah. work. But again, like a Meowie Halloween is probably my most percentage-wise profitable film. But then like Amityville Christmas Vacation, again, like I got a Fangoria Chainsaw Award for that. I was on Shudder being called the maker of the best Amityville. I was on Collider and like all these major websites. The streaming numbers for Amityville kills everything else. And yeah. I think eventually Amityville will be my biggest seller. But, you know, especially now that we have the trilogy of Carousel, we keep on running into people finding the first one and then doing 2 and 3.
Right.
Yeah, they've seen the advertisements for 3 and they're like, what's this? And they go back to 1. So I think Carousel is probably what, like, is the backbone of Silver Spotlight Films, if nothing else, or the heart of it, if you will. I do, you know, I, as a gag, you know, to compare myself as a joke to stuff like the MCU, I do have like chapters of the Silver Spotlight Films.
Yeah.
And like chapter 1 was Slasher Hunter to the Survivors, which was the ending. And then chapter 2 starts with Carousel 1.
Okay.
And it ends with the end of the Meowie movies. And then chapter 3 was starting with Carousel 2. and then ending with Carousel 3. So it is something that has been a huge part of my career and the lives of Aline and I. Again, we first wrote it in 2014. It's 10 years later. And we were able to tell the whole story that we intended. The whole character arc, you know, the conclusion. And it's cool that it's behind us. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do Curtains for Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, because since 2021, we did Carousel 2, a sequel. Amityville Christmas Vacation, technically original for us, but it's part of a big air quotes here franchise. Shingles the Movie, original for us, but that's an adaptation of a book series. Okay. Carousel 3.
Yep.
Curtains is finally original again after
Gotcha.
4 years.
Right. So going back to something you said earlier, like you talked about how I think it was about 2020, 2021, something like that, where you kind of decided that you'd made it or felt like mm-hmm. you'd made it in some way, shape or form. So what was that like? And what was the actual, like, what do you feel like was the trigger? What was the thing that you were witnessing that made you feel that way?
It was just, it was a multitude of stuff. It was stuff like if you searched my name on Amazon, mm-hmm. it would bring up other talking animal movies.
Okay.
So like I was associated with a genre.
Right.
Carousel 2's Kickstarter. Because I went into that pessimistic because the first one failed. Up to that point, I'd never raised more than like $1,500 on an Indiegogo, which was usually just for part of a budget or like just for like a Blu-ray special release or something. And Carousel 2 made its five figures on Kickstarter. The fans showed me that they wanted it. We were able to shoot it. We were able to get it out. And then immediately I'm getting hired to produce and direct a movie the next year, which was Shingles.
Right.
So it was like, it's all, you know, I've been doing it as a career since about 2014. But it was like on the teetering edge, and like it was a lot of like, I also worked for Marvel Live. I still do technically, but since the shutdowns, that's kind of gone away. And like those things combined is how I was able to make a living off of entertainment.
Yeah.
But 2021 is kind of where only the movies was how I was making a living off of entertainment.
Wow. Okay. And that was my next question was, are you making a living off of making these movies? And
yes.
Wow. Okay. That's fantastic.
Now I'm not hugely successful. One of the main reasons why I live in the Pittsburgh area is the low cost of living and how this house cost me nearly nothing back in 2017. I'll be totally upfront and honest. If I'm lucky, I make about 30 to 35K a year.
Okay.
Which isn't a lot, but it's a living, especially in a two-income household.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I really appreciate your honesty with that because it kind of, it helps for listeners to get an idea of the numbers that are involved. Like you're not making 200,000, you're not making some big, you know, salary kind of thing. You know, you're giving up a sort of, you know, what a life that you could pursue maybe where you would make some kind of salary like that if you wanted to as a computer programmer or something like that, you know. And instead you're choosing to live this life, but it is sustaining you in a small way.
Yes.
And there's so much value that's associated with that. And that's really, really cool. It's not something that very many filmmakers can say. And I think filmmakers who work with higher budgets than you do, or, you know, have, you know, well-paying, good-paying day jobs and things like that, you know, they still struggle to like even get one film where they can feel like they're, you know, being able to sustain the next film, let alone being able to actually live off of that, you know? So
I'm lucky.
That's really cool and terrific. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, luck, you know, everything, there's always luck involved. And I don't mean to say that you're not lucky, but at the same time, you have done, you've made some choices that have led to,
Both. You for know, sure.
Yeah.
I've run into a lot of guys that are like, so against the idea that all of their success is only thanks to all of their hard work. Like we're all working hard, man.
Yeah.
I just so happened to make, I made some choices for sure that ended up being good, but I also was just several times, right place, right time.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's great to acknowledge both. And I think that that's, you know, I think even the most, you know, even Steven Spielberg was lucky, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are times that he wouldn't have become who he'd become without some kind of luck happening, some kind of emergence of things, you know. So kind of like then talking about the kind of more recent years, you know, maybe mm-hmm. from around that 2021 time to up through now, like, what do you think that you've learned from your experiences of the previous decade kind of into this decade, especially like post-pandemic where things have definitely changed? You know, what changes have you seen and what have you learned from that? And how have you kind of pivoted your strategy about putting out these films, releasing these films and making money from them?
Well, again, one of the big changes I've already touched on is just streaming. It's good in the sense that it has gotten me a lot of new eyes on my products that people wouldn't have watched my movies or bought my movies or found me otherwise.
Yeah.
But the percentage of those people that then are like, come back as fans or like actually follow me is pretty low. So it's a case where, like, again, I'm trying to stay diverse in what I'm making. You know, if I get hired for something, I'll do that. We had the Amityville, which was another PG thing, and I knew I wanted that to be PG because of how well the cat movies did.
Yeah.
And now we got Curtains, which is going to be another. It's kind of like a greatest hits of my career, where it's like the wackiness of Cara's Hell and the gore of Cara's Hell, but the sweetness and the love for Christmas that Amityville Christmas Vacation was. And there's nice. Even a fake movie in the movie, A Cheesy Christmas, which is a riff on my Meowie Christmas movies. But it's also like trying to find the ways to connect with people that are finding my thing so that then they start associating me with the product. You know, I used to almost never use Twitter. And then in the past few years, I've started using it more often, where I will just search Cara's Hell, Shingles, you know, and then if I just find someone that I haven't seen their post yet saying that they saw the movie and they found it and they liked it, or even that they didn't like it, I'll reply to them and just say, hey, thanks for checking it out, glad you dug it, or, you know, sorry you didn't like it, but thanks for giving it a chance. And that has actually gotten me a lot of success. It has gotten me a lot of people being like, oh wow, you know, this guy's an okay guy. Or even the Letterboxd reviews, if someone is like gushing about the movie, I will reply and say, thank you so much, like, you picked up what I was putting down, and that's super cool.
Yeah, that does seem to be like, you know, to be where you're at, it seems like you'd have to engage with social media in some way, shape, or form to be able to kind of sustain that. I mean, what do I know? I could be wrong, but it just seems like
that is
a vital component of what you do. Yeah.
At this point, like I said earlier, you know, at the risk of sounding like that sort of narcissistic, I am part of the product. You know,
yeah, no, I don't think that's narcissistic
connection,
at all.
People's connection with me. I have noticed that the movies I'm not in don't do as well because people like seeing me in the
Interesting.
Movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you know, I gave myself a part, but a smaller part in Curtains, so I can focus a little bit more. Like, I'm not the protagonist of Curtains, but it is because of fan demand that Joe the Pizza Guy comes back in Cara's Hell 3.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not my choice. I didn't even want to be in Cara's Hell 1, but years of being like, is Joe back? Is Joe coming back? Is Joe coming back? Is Joe coming back? I said, all right, guess he's coming back, but not in the way you want him to. I'm still going to tell the story I want to tell.
Right, right.
But, like, it's that sort of thing where, and, like, my Facebook page is probably my most successful social media page. And, like, I just keep trying to, like, stay interacting. I try to keep posting stuff that's funny, but, like, it's genuinely me. It's not me just being a character of, like, I need to do my social media things. Like, no, I'll post dumb stuff. I will post dumb reviews. I'll post my action figures. I'll post dumb thoughts. And I'll be real sometimes, too, and post about depression or, like, bad days that I'm having. Nice. But I keep up with it and, like, keep talking to people because that also helps spread me as part of the product.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier, which is kind of this notion of, like, bypassing all of the screens between you and your fans and just having this one kind of direct relationship with your fans. Not only are you delivering material for them that they're paying for kind of directly back to you, but you also are engaged with them as a real person, you know? And so there's a social connection there that I think is something that we sorely need in this modern era of, like, you know, sitting down in your living room and turning on your TV and watching a movie and never interacting with anybody. I mean, we don't even go to movie theaters as much anymore. So we're not even interacting with the people, you know, next to us, you know, hearing them laugh at the same jokes or whatever it is, you know. So having that, like, personal connection, I think, is, like, really, really important and vital and cool. So I think it's great for you to, like, for you to talk about your depression and, you know, whatever else is going on in your personal life as much as you care to share, because that gives people that, you know, feeling that when they sit down and watch your movie that, you know, I know this person a little bit, you know.
To work off of that, as something you may have not been hearing about this sort of thing either, but I've also found a lot of success in the fact that I've done screenings of my movies on Discord channels. Uh-huh. So, like, I've been invited as a guest to the Shudder Discord channel, or the Joe Bob Ribs Discord and stuff, or, like, other horror Discords where, like, Aline and I will show up. If any of the other cast and crew are free, they'll show up too. Or, like, we stream my movie. Sometimes it'll be, like, before it's even out. Like, I do that for the Shudder Discord because they've given me a lot of love over the years. And, like, we're there live with these, like, 50 to 200 people that may have not known us prior to this moment.
Yeah.
And now we're live answering questions. Or, you know what, I'm having a few drinks and I'm, like, saying dumb stuff about my own movie. And, like, it's usually a really, really positive experience, both in terms of, like, as a creator, but also to continue building those relationships, those new fans, you know, those people that might be like, oh, let's see what else this guy has done. So that's not as common as a thing I would suggest. That is definitely something that like a filmmaker would have to build up to. I wouldn't have been able to do that in 2012.
Right.
But it's a great modern thing that didn't exist then.
Yeah, that's really cool too. So at this point, are you basically like self-distributing all of your movies?
Yes.
And then so talk about that. Was that a kind of a decision that you made at some point that you would just do that and not bother to find distributors or, you know, like what
Well, it was a decision where like I always knew that was probably the better bet.
Yeah.
In terms of financial decisions.
Yeah. And when did you make that decision?
Like 2011.
Yeah. So you had that first distributor of your first feature. And was it basically after that?
No. So I did MVD.
Yeah.
And again, I did that because I needed that push. I needed that push that I didn't have yet. I knew it was going to be for marketing. Zoltan Zeli, who was the client that hired me for Captain Z. It was his movie.
Yeah. So that was up to them to distribute. Right.
So he signed up through a distributor called SGL.
Okay.
They didn't do a lot of work on the film, but he's gotten checks from them. So, you know, at the end of the day, he's gotten paid, so it's fine. And they still have the rights to the movie, I think, to this point. And then I went through Wild Eye Releasing for Karis Hell, and I knew I was only going through Wild Eye to try to get to the Wild Eye fan base, because there is a group of people that will, like, watch every Wild Eye movie no matter what. I was like, I want Karis Hell to reach a bunch of new eyes. And then I'll be back on my own for like the sequels. I knew Carousel 2 was going to be self-distribution at that point. Like I knew that was going to be the case. And then as soon as the contract date came up for Carousel 1, I was like, time to get these rights back.
Wow. Okay. How long was that term?
It was 5 years from the signing of the contract, but they didn't release the movie to DVD for 3 years after the release. I signed the contract.
Okay. So they only had it out for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
But it's just a case where like, again, if someone's just starting out, I always tell them, like, there is positives to going through a distribution company. It is that they have a fan base, or they'll send out a ton of copies to, like, YouTube reviewers that review all of their movies, to horror websites, like press kits and stuff like that, emails that you may not have access to. But you need to do your research, because if it is a distributor that's just like, oh, we have our movies on Tubi and Amazon, like, you can do that yourself. If it's a distributor saying like, hey, don't forget, you're going to do most of your marketing, then what are they doing?
Yeah.
They're not doing anything. They're just going to be taking, and you these days, well, always, honestly, it's a miracle that I got checks from MVD, but that's how good of a company they were. It's so hard to actually get any payments from a distribution company. It's not worth it if you want paid. It is only worth it if you want more marketing that you don't have access to.
Right.
I'm at a point where I don't need that marketing anymore. And like, I still have distribution companies reaching out to me for the Meowie movies, for Amityville, for the Carousel sequels. And I immediately say like, hey, not to be rude, I can already do most of what you can offer.
Yeah.
I'm only interested in working with you if you're giving me an upfront payment. And it's never an upfront payment, because that's not how they work.
Not anymore.
Yeah. And it's just, it's not worth it financially. Again, like, we're lucky that a place like Film Hub exists, which does get us onto like multiple streaming services, and they are a middleman, but they take way less of a cut than any distributor would. You get way more up-to-date readings on your payouts of what every single channel is paying you. You're able to put it directly into your account. You're not waiting on some quarterly release. And man, some of these quarterly releases I've saved, and from other people that have made movies of my friends, and the fake numbers we get, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's just that case where, like, I know that I can do better for myself than almost any distribution company, except for the big boys, but the big boys are never going to call me.
Right. But well, you never know. But yeah,
true.
Who knows? Right.
But in my level,
yeah,
I don't need them.
Yeah.
It's
that
simple.
Totally. Right. So do you use Film Hub then to do your, like, okay, just to aggregate getting stuff out to the various platforms and things like that?
Yeah. I use Film Hub for that. And I use Kunaki for my physical copies.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So how do you find Film Hub to work with?
I mean, they're fine. You know, like, I've never really had any complaints. You know, if you're used to making your own art, it's great. If you aren't, then it can be a huge uphill battle, I'll say that. But I've always made my own box art and, like, my own marketing art and stuff. Even if I hire someone to make a poster art, I'll still be like, send me the PSD file so I can rearrange stuff for every shape.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like that sort of stuff I'm used to. If there's a problem, they say, hey, you got to move the title in somewhere closer. Yeah. I'm like, okay, no problem. You know, I got the captions made, you know, no problem. I got all this done and I'm used to doing all of this stuff myself already, that it really wasn't that much of an ask for when it's like a very hands-off, you do most of the work yourself, but we'll get you onto the platforms.
Yeah.
I haven't had any problems with them. I know recently in the past year, I've seen a lot of guys just starting out reporting that like they aren't getting their payouts from FilmHub.
Yeah.
But I think part of that was FilmHub did this big website update and I think they did it too early.
Okay. Right.
I think that's just causing issues, but also part of it is just like the streaming services are paying slower compared to what they were. But again, like it's done surprisingly okay for me. And like, I know some guys where they submit a movie and it takes like 3 months or 4 months for them to get onto the services. When I submitted Amityville, I was on Tubi a week later. So wow. I don't know if it's a timing thing that like Tubi was desperate for Christmas movies that were family friendly, or if I'm making Tubi enough money, they're like, oh, is this a Steve Wozinski?
Yeah, who knows?
Pass it on, yeah.
And I think that's like the one, you know, the one kind of big problem with FilmHub, even though FilmHub, I think, gives you a lot of transparency in certain ways. You still have no idea like kind of what's going on behind the scenes in terms of who's grabbing your movie when and putting it up when and all that kind of thing. And just wish we had more transparency into that process somehow. I don't know.
I wish we were at least given like release dates.
Yeah.
From the services. That alone would like.
Well, I guess there's like a pro changer. Service. There's like a pro service now, I think.
Yeah, where you can control that.
I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I hear you. Right. Yeah. So, and
I'd rather go on and be a surprise.
Yeah. And I think in your situation, it doesn't matter that much because you have this kind of loyal fan base that's they're going to come out whenever you release and whatever. Like you're not banking too much on like any given marketing push or whatever. You know, just kind of put your stuff out there, fans find it, and you move.
I'll have the image ready that says Carousel 3 is now on Tubi, and as soon as I notice it's on Tubi, I'll post on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and like pay the $10 promo just to push it onto more eyes, and that's it.
Yeah. So just kind of on that subject, do you have any other like kind of promotional things that you do when you put one of these movies out? Any efforts that you undertake and do you spend any money on that or like how does that go?
I do a few small things. Like I said, I'll do a little bit of like paid advertising on Instagram and Facebook. Not too much because it's not massively successful, but just to kind of get in some people's feeds. You know, I do target the horror fans.
Yeah. Do you have any way of like kind of figuring out whether you're actually getting any kind of measurable return on that or is it just,
really,
just kind of guessing? Yeah.
Now what I'll do if it's a Tubi advertisement, I will make it so that it's the button that you click on takes you to the Tubi page of the movie itself.
Right.
And Facebook will at least show me how many people clicked on it.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people watched it.
Right.
I'll also do stuff in like when I have a new major release, I'll do it just like once a year. I don't do too much, but it's just like, hey, everyone like and share this and you're entered to win every one of my movies on DVD or Blu-ray. And like, that's like $50 out of pocket, but that is like thousands and thousands of interaction of like people seeing that image. So that's something that I've noticed does pretty decently at just getting the post spread. So people are aware of it. Even if it doesn't give me that many direct sales, it pushes it way further than me spending the $50 to $100 on an ad.
Yeah.
And we try to do stuff with like different media. Again, we did the Carousel deck building game. Mm-hmm. We also have a Meowie expansion and then Shingles the movie, the game. And we did that because we know there are people that like games that may not like our movies. And when we were taking that game to conventions, it was a case where like people who liked my movies but weren't into deck building games wanted to play because they liked my movies. They liked the game enough that they bought the game. Mm. It doesn't make us much money. It's like $2 or $3 after all costs.
Yeah, okay, but it's something.
But then people who didn't know my movies have been playing the games, and the game is like all of our movies. Like, it's Carousel, the deck-building game, but it's characters from everything.
Oh,
and
interesting.
Like, and on each card it says, oh, Meowie Christmas, Meowie, like whatever it's from. And people that like the games have played the game and like the game, and they've bought my movies because of the game. That's what the investment was.
Right,
it wasn't
right.
to make money off the game.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's super cool. Okay, so winding things down here, do you have any sort of words of wisdom or advice for filmmakers, anything that we haven't already talked about that you want to offer, put out there?
If you're a fresh filmmaker, my go-to advice is learn the words good enough.
yeah,
You need to understand that the whole project matters. Not one scene, not one shot, not one line. It may not be perfect, but if you have something that works, that is good. I'm not saying accept garbage, but if you have something that's good but not perfect,
yeah,
that's got to do. Because if you are so hyper-focused on one thing being perfect, you're going to keep doing that. And when you start doing that, you're going to go over budget. You're going to go over schedule. And you're not respecting the time of your cast and crew. You know, if you're hyper-focused on that sort of thing, you're going to be wasting a lot of time getting a lot of people tired, and the whole project is going to suffer from that. No one is going to know that that shot wasn't exactly what you had envisioned, but they will notice that the whole movie feels like trash now, and it's because you wasted all this time and then had to rush in these other aspects. Yeah. So that is always what I tell someone just starting out. You got to learn good enough, perfection. You know, it's something that's unknowable and is also around us all the time. So just go with it. Like, know what you need, get what you need, and then play around after that. And that's one of the reasons why I think I'm so good at scheduling, is because that's always been my mindset.
Yeah.
You know, I schedule 8 hours a day. I don't want to work more than 8 hours. Yeah. I don't know why people voluntarily do that. And it's because of hyper-focused stuff like that. Like, no, we need these pages. We're going to get this shot. Oh, we're 2 hours early. Let's try this in a different way. Yeah. Let's try this in a different way. And we're wrapped.
Right. Great advice. Appreciate that. Anything else we didn't cover that you wanted to cover, or you know, anything?
Last reminder for your for your listeners. You know, if you want to support me, you know, number one way, silverspotlightfilms.com, buying my DVDs, buying my Blu-rays, that is coming directly to me. I'm shipping that directly to you.
Nice.
If you don't have a player, or you don't do physical, or you want to try more stuff out, that's fine. Again, stevebuster.com. That will take you to the Patreon. $3, all the modern movies. $5, all the bonus features, all the old stuff that I made in high school that I don't sell anymore, but my fans wanted it because they hate me. So that's on there. And Discord access, if you're into that sort of thing. And third place, you know, economy's tight, economy's rough. I understand. All of my movies are on Tubi. You can watch them on Tubi. I do get money from that. That is an official, legitimate way to support me. Please don't use an ad blocker, you son of a bitch. That's all I ask.
Yeah, hear you. Okay, so yeah, you've got a great story. I'm really glad that I reached out to you to be on the show. I think like your story from back when you got started all through now, I think will be great for listeners to hear and take, you know, whatever away they can take away from it. So appreciate you coming on the show, and it's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me. I hope that, you know, some of the stuff that I said helps someone
make
a little bit more money.
I think it will. All right, that's all for today. Thanks everybody for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate and or review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. That is the best way that you can help me grow the show and reach a wider audience of independent filmmakers and others who just want to try to understand this crazy, crazy world of independent film distribution. As always, feel free to contact me directly with any feedback or suggestions for the show. You can find me on Twitter, or should I say X, or Instagram at DarkRoseColin, or you can email me at Colin@DarkRosePictures.com. That's Colin with one L, C-O-L-I-N, at DarkRosePictures.com. And by the way, DarkRosePictures.com is my website for my feature and other projects. Its purpose is not just to promote my films, but to tell the story with honesty and transparency of my own personal filmmaking journey. So if you want to follow the process of an independent filmmaker from development to distribution, this is a great way to do that. So check it out, DarkRosePictures.com. Anyway, a big thanks to Steve Rudzinski for sharing his inspiring journey with us. Another big thanks to Jeff Reimuth for keeping up with the editing work. I've got more great guests lined up in the coming weeks talking all things indie distribution, so please stay tuned, keep getting those movies out there into the world, and thank you so much for listening. See you next week.